Hello, and welcome to Healthy Bottom Line, a podcast from Chief Healthcare Executive. I'm Ron Southwick, lead editor of Chief Healthcare Executive. We're talking today with Kyle Zebley, the Senior Vice President of Public Policy at the American Telemedicine Association. We had a very important and timely conversation about telehealth, the fight to extend waivers in Washington, hospital-at-home programs, and what to expect from the new administration and Congress. Thanks for joining us, and we'll get started in just a second. This is Healthy Bottom Line. Well, hello, and welcome to Healthy Bottom Line, a podcast from Chief Healthcare Executive. I'm Ron Southwick, lead editor of Chief Healthcare Executive. We're talking today with Kyle Zebley, the Senior Vice President of Public Policy at the American Telemedicine Association. He's also the Executive Director of ATA Action, the affiliated trade association that focuses on advocacy. So, Kyle, thanks so much for joining us today.
Great. Thanks so much. Really happy to be here, Ron.
Okay, so well, there's obviously a whole lot to talk about in telehealth. There's a lot of people that have been anxious about the federal government extending telehealth approvals, and it looks like the clock is ticking on another deadline. So tell us about where we are in terms of extending telehealth.
Yeah, so here we are right now as we record this. It's getting close to mid-February, February 10th. And that means that we're coming up on just a few weeks prior to the latest extension expiring. And this is something that the telehealth community's gotten used to. And while we're not happy about it per se, it is just a fact of life. And I think it's emblematic of how Washington, D.C. now operates. In short, we got at the end of 2022 an extension of a lot of key telehealth provisions at the federal level that were put in place during the pandemic. Medicare telehealth flexibilities, acute hospital care at home, a high deductible health plan, first dollar coverage for health savings accounts. That's an inducement to use telehealth for the tens of millions of Americans with high deductible health plans and health savings accounts. We got that extended till the end of 2024. Advocates for telehealth in the community, like the ATA, like ATA Action, talk to members of Congress, members of the Biden administration, members of the Trump campaign and transition team throughout 2023 and 2024, trying to build the case for why the telehealth flexibilities that were extended should be made permanent. Unfortunately, Congress waited till the last minute. They often do this. We were in an initial version of a spending bill in mid-December of last year in 2024 that would have done another 2 year extension for a lot of these flexibilities. Also would have done 5 years for a few others that really require long-term planning, like acute hospital care at home, like an expansion for telehealth in the diabetes prevention program. Unfortunately, for reasons much more different than us and having nothing to do with us, that bill ended up being killed. And folks that watch the news could probably remember what happened is President Trump, Elon Musk didn't like the sheer breadth and size of the bill in the last final days of the Biden administration. So we got a much slimmed down package. We unfortunately lost really important items, which I'm happy to talk about later. And we also were able to get Medicare telehealth extended along with acute hospital care at home, but only until the end of March of this year. So we're waiting to see what kind of legislative vehicle there might be so that we can get a ride on that vehicle and if not make permanent, extend these flexibilities for as long as possible.
Well, yeah, that clock is ticking kind of quickly, as we're in almost mid-February now. Obviously, this requires a crystal ball to really answer the question fully, but what is your expectation at this point? Do you think you can get a multi-year extension that you've been working on for so long, or is it more likely it might be another 3 month extension while Congress kind of really gets settled in and works on like sort of bigger spending packages?
Well, I think it's safe to say early in this second era of President Trump that keeping up with events day by day can be enough as surprises come our way frequently. But I will say this, I do think that we're going to get an extension. I know that sounds like an out. It doesn't exactly answer your question. I'll elaborate in a moment. But I think we're going to get an extension for the Medicare telehealth flexibilities that will not be allowed to expire at the end of March. If I were a betting man, those are the safest bets that you could make. I would it be for 2 years? Would we bring back, for instance, some of the contours of what was in that initial omnibus bill that unfortunately ended up being scuttled? Yes, it's certainly a possibility. At minimum, however, if folks are scrambling, and depending on which legislative vehicle we catch a ride on, so, as they say, we might be in store for another short-term extension, hopefully on the road to a longer extension or permanency later on this year if we were to get a kind of short kick the can down the road. Some of the kind of vehicles that we're as a community circling up on, and which in our conversations with folks on Capitol Hill, both Republicans and Democrats, it's clear these are actively in play, will again determine the length of that extension. There's a possibility of a health care package that would consist of a whole host of items that were ended up being dropped from the omnibus bill. I think that would give us an opportunity for a really lengthy extension, maybe 2 years for Medicare telehealth flexibilities, 2 years for the tax provision, 5 years for acute hospital care at home, 5 years for this expanded diabetes prevention program. That would be great. There's a reconciliation package that's making its way around the Republican majority in the House and Republican majority in the Senate. That'd be a more partisan package, but that might give us a little bit more of an opportunity to include these bipartisan objectives for a longer extension. And then finally, there's the possibility a third, maybe legislative vehicle would be a spending package. The government needs to stay open for the rest of the fiscal year. It'll expire in the middle of next month, funding. If we were to be included in another kind of spending package like we were most recently at the end of December, that might be our shortest term extension because it would likely coincide with the rest of the fiscal year, which would only get us to the end of September. Of course, our bottom line message to our allies on Capitol Hill, our great ally in the Trump administration and the key personnel that are staffing that administration, is please give us the longest extension possible if we're not going to get permanency in order to allow for planning for providers and patients alike. But we'll see what happens.
Yeah, it's been a very rapid news cycle out of Washington these last few weeks, to say the least. So keeping pace of everything is a challenge, to say the very least. The hospital at home programs, there was a lot of excitement in the last year, especially and with the short-term spending package initially having a 5-year extension for hospital at home plans, which a lot of health systems have been hoping for. And as you talk about in terms of planning, I think some systems have been waiting to either implement or expand their programs, because they wanted some more certainty from Washington as they were doing. So do you feel like there's a, beyond just like sort of the immediacy of what's going on with legislation, but do you feel like there's some pretty strong support for supporting acute hospital at home programs through telehealth?
Yes, I think there's very much strong support. I think that support is indicated in a few different ways. One is the fact that it, got extended for 2 years alongside all the other Medicare-related flexibilities at the end of 2022 on a bipartisan basis, signed into law by President Biden. And I think another sign of support was that in the initial bipartisan deal that we were able to achieve through painstaking discussions year in, year out with both Republican and Democratic leaders and key staff and leadership on key committees of jurisdiction, the fact that we were able to get baked into this big bipartisan package a 5-year extension for the acute hospital care at home program again is a sign of support. When there was a massive slim down of the omnibus package at the end of last year. Originally, the draft was 1,500 pages long, included lots of provisions. Because of the intervention by President Trump and Elon Musk, Republican leaders scrambled to drop, paste, delete, a huge chunk of the 1,500 pages. They whittled it all the way down to a little over 100 pages. The fact that acute hospital care at home and Medicare telehealth flexibilities were included, albeit for a shorter 3-month extension, again, is a sign of the strong support that we have. So my expectation is at a minimum, acute hospital care at home will be tied with the other Medicare telehealth flexibilities and getting them extended And likely at this point in time, probably for the same length of extension as Medicare flexibilities, particularly if it's a little bit shorter.
Telehealth has generally enjoyed really strong bipartisan support, as you've mentioned in this conversation and the times we've talked in the past. I mean, lawmakers both sides of the aisle have really been strong supporters and advocates even for telehealth. Do you sense any diminishment of support, just judging from the new changes in Washington and some new lawmakers in the Capitol? Do you sense any change in support for telehealth, or do you still feel like you've got that strong bipartisan backing that you've enjoyed in recent years?
We've got really strong bipartisan backing. So, in short answer to your question, yes, I think we're still as strong as ever, and I do not believe, no, that I do not believe that there's been any significant diminishment. However, important caveats I'd like to get across in kind of elaborating a little bit. All these flexibilities at the end of the day that we're talking about at the federal level, more or less, were put in place by President Trump. And they were put in place about half a decade ago, 5 years ago, if you can believe it. And I bet your listeners and fans will do a little bit of oh my gosh, has it really been 5 years? Yes, it's been 5 years. All these things were put in place by President Trump, either through unilateral executive action or through work and collaboration with the Congress on a bipartisan basis. Because keep in mind, at that time in 2020, the President Trump was working with a Democratic House and a Republican Senate, so divided government. All of these flexibilities ended up being kept in place through the end of the Trump administration and kept in place on a bipartisan basis by President Biden and Vice President Harris, his administration working on a bipartisan basis with Congress. Again, there's a lot of signs of support for telehealth on a bipartisan basis. So, what are our big obstacles if we've got such a bipartisan, broad-based support? I think the biggest obstacle is the dysfunctionality of Congress and how we administer government at the federal level here in Washington, D.C. That's knocking nobody, it's knocking everybody. I say that as somebody that worked in the executive branch, worked in the legislative branch, has seen how things work or don't work up close. And it's unfortunate that we're at a place in time where Congress can almost give themselves a pat on the back for keeping the lights on. And this has been a struggle, as noted through all of our government shutdowns and all of the theatrics leading up to government funding ending or debt ceiling votes being necessary. The brinkmanship, the work that goes into just doing the very basic work of government has become exceedingly difficult. And then overlay that with this moment in time we find ourselves in early 2025, where the new president, who has been a strong supporter of telehealth, there's no doubt about it. I couldn't say it long enough, strongly enough, it's true. But he is dealing with a whole host of other priorities. And one of the things that the telehealth community has to be very aware or mindful of is that as difficult as it is for Congress to do their day job and keep government funded, keep the lights on, make sure we're delivering high quality services to the American people, we're also dealing with a whole host of other political battles. And it doesn't have anything to do with telehealth necessarily. It could have some impact on telehealth down the line. And we just have to be mindful that we don't get lost in the shuffle. That we don't get forgotten about and all the noise that is going on. And again, as we speak, Ron, just to kind of blow your mind as much as I would blow my own mind, here we are starting on the fourth official business week of the Trump administration. And it feels like I've lived many lives just since Inauguration Day on January 20th of last month.
Yeah, it feels like it's been longer than 4 weeks for sure. So absolutely. But this is where I talk about how old I am. I remember back in the day when I was covering Washington in the early part of the 2000s, 2000, 2002. The legislative process has changed a lot since then, specifically like appropriations. Because I mean, I remember I would go to countless hearings on different spending bills related to higher education, research. I mean, there'd be over a dozen or more spending bills of different areas, like say education, research, and then it'd be lumped together. It was a long process, and without getting too much into how sales was made, but it was a lot more. There were a lot more opportunities for it seems like for parties to make their case about why this area needs more funding, just a bit more of a rigorous look at, what should be going into the budget. The appropriation process just seems like remarkably different than it was not too long ago. Is that your perspective as well?
100%. And I think it's a great test in point to think back if you're talking about the early 2000s, a time period where a lot of the major initiatives of the then new George W. Bush administration, including prior to 9/11, were done on a totally bipartisan basis. His tax package of tax cuts during a time coming out of the surplus years of the late 90s, early 2000s, and ensured that he had a bipartisan group of supporters, a lot of Democrats that supported his tax cuts. And No Child Left Behind, his signature legislative proposal prior to the September 11th terrorist attacks, done on a totally bipartisan basis, working in conjunction with the then powerful Senate committee chair, Ted Kennedy. Again, wow, what a difference a few decades make. And to your point, the appropriations package, which believe it or not is still alive and well, meant that you broke down into various categories. I think you're right, roughly a dozen categories, various subcommittees that work through line by line discretionary government spending. And oftentimes there would be bipartisan coalitions that would formulate over the course of those appropriations discussions that really did make their way, usually in a more consolidated package, to the president's desk for signature. A lot of things have changed during that time frame. Things that I know your listeners know well, that includes more stark partisan divides, and the fact that the two political parties have become more consistent in their ideology and outlook on life, regardless of geographic differences and distinctions. And then you just also have a lot of muscle memory and scar tissue that has been built up over ensuing decades of partisan battle. Throw that all into the mix, this idea that you really have to kind of, for lack of a better term, jam one or both chambers at the last minute with heavy cudgels to force action out of otherwise reluctant chambers. That means that so much power ends up being consolidated in the leaderships, whether it's Republican or Democrat, in both of those chambers. And you get these big, massive, frankly, again, to use maybe blunt terms, like kind of Frankenstein bills that are pieced together very last minute, in which members of both the House and Senate have all of 72 or 96 hours to review, speak about, debate, and ultimately vote on. Usually, right before, again, something catastrophic happens, Americans stand to lose out directly from congressional inaction. Other kinds of, ticking clock scenarios, often done right at the end of a period of work, where it's the end of the year and you want to go home for Christmas, or it's the end of summer and you want to go home for your August district work period, these types of things. But anyhow, yeah, it's not an ideal way to work, and there's no easy way out of the situation I think we're in, which again has nothing to do with telehealth, but we've got to live in the world where this is how government works here in Washington, D.C.
Well, you mentioned something earlier I wanted to get back to, because obviously the short-term extensions at least included extensions for main telehealth programs, hospital home programs into March. But there were some things that were left out. So what are some of the things that are left out that you are hoping to address as you look at some of these other extensions of telehealth?
A few major provisions were unfortunately left out, as you mentioned, and it was left out because of the great slim down that the bill went through. And I think it's a sign of our great bipartisan champions and support that we weren't left out entirely in a ruthless exercise where key congressional leadership and staff had to really work to slim it down to find a way to get passed in both chambers. So, as we mentioned, we got Medicare telehealth flexibility to acute hospital care at home until the end of March. Items that were left out include first dollar coverage for health savings accounts attached to high deductible health plans. That's a tax inducement that's been in place more or less consistently since the beginning of 2020. And it's a way to get people to seek all the wonderful areas of care that you can clinically appropriately receive without a big cost to them. They can immediately start using it without hitting deductibles through their health savings accounts. So, kind of great tax inducement to seek preventative care, to seek telemental health care without a big hit to your wallet. These are tens of millions of Americans. They tend to be Americans that are on the lower end of the economic scale to which this inducement means a lot to them. And it's a great way to get people to do all those things that we keep telling folks that we need on a good preventative care basis to make people live healthier, happier lives, but also to make sure that they're not costing the healthcare system more on a macro level down the road because of unmet care. So a huge, huge tax provision that we're a big supporter of that we're going to hope will come back to life as soon as possible, because here we are in the second full week of February, and that's been allowed to lapse since January 1. Another area that we'd love to see brought back is expanding the diabetes prevention program, again, thinking that through this preventative care lens of how we can drive savings and make sure people live healthier, happier lives. We're really seeking to expand the diabetes prevention program in Medicare to include a whole host of telehealth, virtual care, digital health tools that will allow for those tens of millions of Americans. They tend to be our older Americans, 65 plus, put provisions in place to prevent diabetes. And if anything's going to save a huge amount of money moving forward, putting aside the great way that people's lives can be better by preventing them having onset diabetes, adult onset diabetes, this is a great way to do it. It was included in that little original omnibus bill, and it was slimmed down consequently. There were a few things that weren't in the omnibus bill at all that we would frankly love to see Congress take action on, including bringing back a provision that allowed for telehealth to be an accepted benefit. That was put in place early in the pandemic, kept in place for 3 years until May of 2023, and was allowed to lapse. This is the difference between some access to care and no access to care for millions of Americans that could benefit from it that did during the fact that it was put in place for all those years. And so that's something that we're really mindful of. And then we always want Congress to be very active in the whole conversation around remote prescribing of controlled substances. We're trying to work right now through the Drug Enforcement Administration, their new rulemaking process, to get that to a good place. But one of the cleanest and easiest ways to continue to allow for access in that area of care would be to get Congress to clarify things through legislation. We haven't been successful to date, and we're still working through the executive branch in that area. But it's an important one to continue to keep members of Congress focused on.
You mentioned the remote prescription of certain drugs and working with the DEA. Where are things? Because I know you're obviously looking for some legislative remedies, but through the DEA, what are they proposing at this point? What are the implications for providers?
Well, in short, and again, we're all talking about these items put in place by President Trump and his administration early in the pandemic. We're talking about a waiver of a prior in-person requirement that had been embedded in law. And this has allowed for a provider to establish a prescribing relationship with a patient for purposes of some Schedule II and most every Schedule III through V controlled substances. What this means is that it's been in place for 5 years, this waiver. And what it means is that Americans can receive clinically appropriate access to care where and when they need it, including for purposes of prescribing of controlled substances. Has to be done by a licensed medical professional, has all types of requirements, including making sure that this adheres to the standard of care in the best interest of the patient. Lots of layers of accountability in place at the federal level and at the state level if something goes awry. And so we do think that this expanded access has been a real benefit. The Congress has already acted, first way back in 2008, again in 2019, to grant the Drug Enforcement Administration authority to come up with a permanent framework that wouldn't require or necessitate an in-person visit in order to establish this prescribing relationship. DEA hasn't been able to do it yet. They have put in place a permanent framework for prescribing of buprenorphine, a Schedule III controlled substance that is used to treat substance use disorder. But that rule, which was just finalized in the final days of the Biden administration, still has a lot of unanswered questions that we're seeking clarity from the DEA on. And it doesn't seem like for that really sensitive community, receiving buprenorphine treatment via telemedicine, that you'd still require another permanent framework. And the DEA is putting forward this other framework called a special registration process in a draft rule that is open for public comment right now. We don't think it's workable for Schedule II controlled substance prescribing. They've put a lot of onerous restrictions there for those controlled substances. And so we have real serious concern that it doesn't allow for the full potential of telehealth. There's a huge backwards leap in terms of access. And we can get into the particulars there if you'd like, but it's just too onerous. For Schedule 3 through 5, we have some real outstanding questions, real concern about feasibility of some of the provisions in the medium term, but it does seem more workable. And so we're right now in the process of finalizing our letter, and it should be out by the end of the week.
Well, with remote prescriptions and even other telehealth services, these seem like they're especially important in more rural areas of the country where it's just harder for people to get access to a doctor, where somebody might be driving an hour or more to their nearest primary care physician, if they even have a primary care physician, or the nearest clinic or outpatient facility. So, how important are these programs for rural health care? And does that also maybe help in terms of engendering support since a lot of the lawmakers in these rural areas are in power right now in Republican districts, and this is the base that helped put President Trump in the White House?
Short answer to your question is yes, this does have a unique, distinct impact, both in terms of a positive, in terms of increased access, and in terms of a negative, in terms of the consequences of the increased access being diminished for rural Americans. It's not limited to them, and it's really important to emphasize that. I think one of the great kind of myths that existed prior to the onset of the pandemic that was busted by the pandemic was the idea that this would be a rural-only tool, telehealth in general. And that's just not proven to be the case. There's lots of reasons for both flexibility for access, for the ease in making adjustments to your everyday life, that suburban and urban Americans have greatly benefited from increased access to telehealth as well. But to your point, yes, rural Americans obviously have distinct healthcare challenges. And we want to make sure that zip codes are not going to be part of your healthcare destiny. And telehealth is a way to ensure that doesn't happen. I think the broad basis of telehealth's efficacy for Americans, regardless of geographic location, is one of many reasons why we have such broad-based bipartisan support, to your point, Ron.
Well, I know we're starting to near the end of our time, but before we wrap up, what is the message you'd like to send to hospital leaders, healthcare leaders, in terms of telehealth and in terms of the message they should be getting from what's happening in Washington and what they should be doing?
Don't sit on the sidelines. Obviously, ideally, your hospital system, your hospital, your providers are some way, shape, and form, what some way, shape, or form are involved in an organizations like the American Telemedicine Association or ATA Action, shameless plug there, in order to make sure that we have the resources to be as effective as possible to make sure these flexibilities don't go away. But even beyond membership in an association, you should be getting involved as healthcare system leaders, as health leaders within your community. That should include the easy ways to get in touch with members of Congress, your two senators. Those calls, those emails, those messages matter. And I say that from the perspective of a former congressional staffer that had to tabulate these types of calls, and they did get a way to get a message to the congressman that really mattered. And also, one of the great employers in every community, always one of, if not the number one employer, is the local hospitals, local health system, providers. These are folks that are very visible in a community, and there's even greater ways to get your voice heard when meeting with, talking to, interacting with major policymakers. So your voice makes a difference. Don't sit on the sidelines would be my biggest takeaway.
Well, again, it's going to be very interesting what happens in Washington over the coming weeks as we face yet another deadline coming up all too quickly. So Kyle, thanks so much for walking us through what's happening in Washington, what's happening in telehealth, and we'll certainly be anxious to see what transpires in Capitol Hill over the next few weeks. So thanks for joining us today, Kyle.
Thank you so much. Really appreciate it, Ron.
Okay. This has been Healthy Bottom Line, a podcast from Chief Healthcare Executive. Thanks for joining us. Take care. Thanks for listening to Healthy Bottom Line, a podcast from Chief Healthcare Executive. You can subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. For the latest healthcare news, compelling features, and deeper dives, visit chiefhealthcareexecutive.com. You can also follow us on LinkedIn, Facebook, and X. I'm Ron Southwick, lead editor of Chief Healthcare Executive. Take care.